Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about the Hessian fly. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at GDUs. Cool Beans That's Corny, or Ag History Minute, we'll talk more about the Hessian fly. Our Cool Beans That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Flubbed it. Skipped the Ag History Minute for a second.
You've only been
but recovered.
You've only been doing this like 254 episodes.
Yep. 255th is the charm, I think. That's when we want to get it right.
It's all right. We forgive you.
We'll clean it up in post-production, man. So
sure.
It'll be fine.
I don't think you will.
I don't think I will either. But we could.
I mean, theoretically, we could. But everyone listening now knows that we didn't.
True.
Because otherwise, if they were hearing this, if they weren't hearing this, then they have no idea. But since they're hearing this,
we could just start over.
We could, but it's going to get hot out today, so we got stuff to do. We're unseasonably warm for September.
This is great. This is what we needed.
For the late corn.
The corn needed it so much.
We may need more than we're going to get, but we'll be thankful for what we get.
True. What I can't believe is it's not growing, like, I thought it would make the corn silage just tank in moisture, and I didn't see it do that at all.
Not yet.
I mean,
no,
it went down, but it didn't really, like, tank. Maybe if you had, like, a real sandy soil and it was burning up, yes, or a disease pressure or something. But in general, it did not make that just go from 70% moisture corn silage to 60% moisture corn silage, like, instantly. So that's good.
You guys excited for the weekend? We got double football. Got Saturday, Sunday football again. It's that time of year. Who are the Badgers playing this weekend?
They got big bad Bama.
Bama?
How bad are they going to lose to Bama?
It's going to be ugly. Like, just looking at performance they've had the first 2 weeks and then watching Ohio State just dismantle Western Michigan. That we were losing to at jump around time for week one. Yeah, it's week one, but we were losing 13-14, and they beat them like 56-0. We do not have a good enough offense and defensive line. That's my assessment.
Oh, the line
right
now?
It's the line. Yep, they're just not good enough. They're decent. They're just like, we're getting skill positions. We got some linebackers. We got good corners, but our defensive line is the weakness of the team. And their offensive line isn't like those Ron Dane. Like, they're not probably in this style offense. They're never going to be those kind of road grader guys, but they're still not good enough.
So you're saying we won't have the Badgers to hold us up for the Lee Quillis-led Packer game?
No. No, I...
Okay.
If they can could keep it... If they can... There are some people saying, like, this could be closer than you think. I don't see it.
It's a home and home, right? So we got it at Badgers this year and then next year at Alabama.
At Tuscaloosa, yeah.
That's cool. Yep. I'm surprised with being Alabama they didn't make us go there first.
Right.
Because most of the time when we've done those, don't we always have to go?
We're like a neutral site in Texas.
Right.
Right.
We
played in LSU down there in Texas, and then they came to Lambeau.
Came to Lambeau, yep.
If it's within three touchdowns, I'll be surprised.
We're going to lose that bad.
I think it's that bad, yeah. I'll come on next week and eat some crow.
I mean, Alabama,
keep it close.
New coach, right? I mean, Alabama's a different team, too, than they've been. So hopefully we can keep it close, but
we'll see. It's not a night game. That makes a difference in Camp Randall at night. That is, it's 11 o'clock. The stadium's probably going to, well, maybe Bama it'll be full, but it's probably not going to be full at kickoff. All the same. Normal things. It does look like good weather, though.
Yeah. No, I'm really the next
hot
10 days are very looking hot. quite warm.
It's crazy how cool at night it gets. Like, it's
so
we're hot during
the fall
day
night temperatures, but
it's still nice
summer day temperatures.
Yeah,
because I don't think it's supposed to dip below 80 in the next 10 days from what I saw. Like, it's Not that it's 88 or, you know, no, super, but it's 80, 81, 82, somewhere in there, which is, for mid-September, not really your expectation.
No.
Not that it's out of the norm to get a few warm days, but to have this long of a stretch, because, I mean, it started Tuesday. No, was it Monday?
Monday.
So
actually, Sunday. I mean, Friday, Saturday. Were
Sunday chilly. Got warmer than you thought. Yeah.
Right. Sunday.
So, I mean, we're looking at potential two-week stretch here of 80-degree weather in September. So, crazy.
Hopefully your chopper has good AC or
right, cab, yeah,
whatever
AC
cab
works.
You have for...
How many guys really think about that in a normal September chopping
No,
day?
Like even combine AC sometimes is like, whatever. But this year into beans, you might...
The reason, usually in the combine, the reason you're turning the AC on is because of the sun.
Right.
It's the hot part of the day, right, and the sun's beating into the cab. That'd be the only reason.
Warming, yep.
So, all right, you guys are ready to jump right into our topic for today? I'm going to talk the Hessian fly. So what is the Hessian fly free date? And I guess we'll find out. So the Hessian fly is the Maiateola destructor, small fly in the gall midge family that's very destructive to wheat crops.
I'm a Hessian without no aggression. If you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah, it's good old Yosemite Sam.
I can't believe you remembered that clip, Matt, yep, from your childhood about... being a Hessian with no aggression.
Todd, you've known this guy forever.
Well,
like,
true.
Is there anything
that doesn't
surprise you?
Doesn't
what
surprise
he
me.
Remembers no. Or the random facts and stuff?
It felt appropriate because I'm not saying I've never heard of the Hessian fly, but it's definitely not something we really spend that much time talking about or thinking about, at least in our part of the world. I'm sure somewhere in the United States it's an issue, but...
What's that? Do you remember in college, Bill, talking about the Hessian fly free date or not? Or don't you?
A little bit.
Okay,
because
I do remember it, but I don't. It was one of those things where you heard about it in college or you read about, but then in practice, nobody really seemed to care. You know, it wasn't like, oh, this is really bad. You know, we got to worry about it or anything. It was just right. Sort of a, you kind of knew about it, but the date to plant wheat kind of fell in line with the free date anyway.
Right.
So it just kind of was like, yeah, whatever.
Right.
Just the name alone gives it that old feeling because we don't really refer to the Germans as Hessians anymore, not since the Revolutionary War. So the Hessian fly being the oldest invasive species in North America. Yeah, like I said, the name kind of gives away how long it's been around, but yeah, it's just not something that we really spend a lot of time talking about.
Maybe the other part, wheat is a very old crop in the Midwest, so obviously some of these things kind of ebb and flow and have problems at times and don't, and this one seems to be in partly that we really haven't been that much concerned about it over the last 40 years. But yeah, the free date was kind of this date that was a best... pest management planting date is what Kansas calls it, and I kind of like that. It was just this suggested planting date that basically in your location you've reached a time that the Hessian flies won't lay eggs and destroy any of your wheat. So it doesn't mean they can, it just means the high of the egg laying is over. So it was kind of a date set up. A lot of these studies were conducted between 1918 and 1935 to develop these dates, so you can see how long ago that is.
Yes, World War One era.
Yes. Yeah, so literally 100 years ago was when these dates were done. Now, some states where this is still a problem, like Kansas, they have updated the dates, like in the last, I think it said 2015. So certain areas, I think, where it is a problem, they've said, okay, this is the date that it's a problem, so they've kind of changed it. But basically the idea here is there'd be a fall brood of adult Hessian flies would emerge and kind of attack that. They would lay eggs in the wheat And basically those eggs then would cause problems in the in your wheat crop. So that's kind of the potential problem here. And again, I like we've kind of been talking about, do you guys even worry about it? Have you ever, I've actually never even seen the eggs or the Hessian fly. I
looked up a picture of it because I was wondering if it, they call it the Hessian fly. I'm guessing it's the origin of the bug, but I was wondering if it had.
We'll get to it in egg history.
Because Hessians are known for their pointed heads. Oh, okay. So that's why I was looking to see if they had like a head with like a little unicorn horn. But it doesn't.
Looks like a mosquito.
Yeah, it looks closer to a mosquito, but yeah.
No, really nothing. And they don't even look that destructive. You wouldn't think a fly would destroy much at all, but it's kind of their the offspring when they have eggs and the midge that comes with them, that's the problem. So they're just, again, certain areas, I think, they are a concern, and a lot of areas are not. Michigan State had a really interesting kind of late article from the last 10 years, and it basically right away in the research showed, this is the first line from the research, it says, while the Hessian fly no longer poses a significant threat to wheat in Michigan, the fly-free date is still a useful resource. So I think that kind of sums it up. Basically, why we don't talk about it, why we don't hear about it is it's really not a significant threat, but if you use these dates as a guide or research, they're still helpful. So one of the other hard parts is you don't want to wait too long to plant wheat either because then your yield goes way down. So we kind of do want to plant as early as possible.
Right.
And the main reason we're talking about this, to be honest with you, is because of this year there's enough prevent plant acres
right.
that were open that we could plant to winter wheat. And the question comes up, like, why not plant it September 1st? Why not plant it August 15th? What is that real date to wait? So in the Midwest, the dates sort of, and they vary from north to south. So if you picture the north area, it kind of starts earlier and then it works its way down. It kind of has to do with when frost normally comes. But here in Wisconsin, our date is kind of September 12th around our area. And then you go to the southern part of the state and it's the 18th of September. So
we're right there.
We're right. So literally,
go right plant there. Your winter wheat. Yes. Don't worry about the Hessians.
The Hessian fly is free.
They have no aggression.
Yes. Correct.
They will not be aggressive today.
So if you planted wheat before now, you have a chance of getting it. But there again, this is just the range of dates. We've talked that in general, you don't get it. And I think that's why as well that we don't talk about it much is this is our normal planting wheat time anyway. It's right when corn silage comes off, yep. Right after maybe a hay field, fourth crop, you're going to plant wheat. Or the third option is after soybean harvest. So it kind of lines up, I think, that way that we don't think much about it. Plus, I see my best wheat yields happen when we plant about September 10th to the 20th. That is the sweet spot, if you ask me, for yep. wheat yields. If we get into October, we see yield loss. As you wait in there, there's another Michigan State had, I think it was at like 0.6 bushel per day after October 1st planting. And I think that that surprised me that it was that low. I thought it'd be actually higher because see it really tail off.
And our rule of thumb, right, is always September 15th, October 15th, right? That's kind of like the window. But you're right, Todd, like planting in that first half of that window for yield-wise.
Correct. If you want to shoot for 100-plus bushel of wheat, you want to have a chance to get it to tiller. You want it out there a little earlier. Not that you can't get that from October 1st to 15th. It's just a little bit harder to do. You need the right weather. You need the right thing to happen. So other states' fly-free dates would be Michigan would be September 6th to the 23rd. I think theirs were updated, too, from the original study, which I thought was unique. Illinois, September 17th to October 12th. Ohio, September 22nd to October 5th. And then Indiana, September 22nd, October 9th. Kansas, September 29th to October 12th.
So really, Illinois and Kansas have the longer, like that's almost a month.
Right.
Illinois, it's September 17th to October 12th. And Kansas is, you know, 2 weeks of range throughout the state.
Right. I think if it's these states that are long north to south.
Well, look at how long they're, Illinois, right?
It's, right. That they've got like a very, so if you're in the northern part of the state for the southern, it's very different.
Yeah.
So, and I, the, what was also odd is Michigan, excuse me, Minnesota, our other neighbor, and North Dakota really didn't, I don't know if they didn't have a problem with this or they get cold enough that it just isn't a problem, but especially in the original research, they're not even really included on the map. So
yeah, there's it's the, just not the September 12th line kind of runs through the base of Minnesota, like, but not, doesn't extend into North Dakota, even like Nebraska. I assume it's intentional, like the line doesn't even go through Nebraska, just kind of like, except for the southern part. So there's, those states just must not have those issues.
So on the original map, it wasn't there, but they talk about kind of the 15th as their date in Minnesota. So I don't know if they just figure...
They felt left out, and they're like, hey, we need a date.
Yeah, right. It does seem that way that they just said, it's probably the 15th, you're good. So,
and we're just cold after that, so...
Right. So again, very, very old data, very old pest, very old bug that may or may not rear its ugly head. But one thing that also coincides with this date is disease potential. So another reason why this date came about was to minimize disease problems that you'd get in the fall. And the biggest one is barley yellow dwarf virus. So BYDV, barley yellow dwarf virus, is transmitted by aphids and tends to be more severe in the fall. Like that transmission occurs earlier. So that also kind of coincide that basically these aphid levels tend to crash around the same time as this fly safe date. So the fly free date, and that kind of coincide. And so one of the bigger things I think for our area is actually barley yellow dwarf virus is we've seen it pop up in wheat fields here and there more than in the past. I don't know if that's a way to say it or if we're just noticing more or guys are planting wheat maybe a little earlier so you can get it. So that is one other thing that this fly free date actually helps with. I actually for a while there thought the Hessian fly transmitted the virus because they kind of coincide. But it's not. It's aphids. It's totally separate. It just, the date kind of works that if you wait, plant a little later, that it helps with some of these other diseases. So there's also some other.
This may be my favorite disease.
Yes. Here. Could you say it, Matt? I'm glad you're going to say it, not me.
Steganospora blotch.
It sounds
like. It sounds like a medical condition that a human would get. Like, oh, yeah, you got the Steganospora blotch. You might want to get that checked.
You might want to get some tough actin on there.
Like thanks, John Madden.
Yes. And leaf rust. So both of those come in late that we can reduce some of those disease problems. So something to consider that really if you're not worried about the Hessian fly, which most of us are not, if you're not, there's the disease factor that can be a part where you get this really good growth in the fall. It's just more time for it to get disease. So the other thing to think about is what other crops are affected by the Hessian fly. So it prefers to feed on wheat, but it can also infest triticale, which makes sense because it's a partner.
Wheat hybrid. Yeah.
Barley and rye. It does not attack oats or rye grass. So certain types of...
Yeah.
Of grass, you know, that's more of the grass species and oats. It will not seem to attack.
There is some oats planted this fall. I mean, after wheat, guys actually did get
like
out
for forage oats and that kind of thing.
That's a bonus.
So that also leads into the next thing, though, is potentially with cover crops as we plant cover crops earlier in the fall after wheat or just depending on the timing. Is you could get it in certain states. You could get it to infest some of your, and obviously we just said the species that it, you know, if you have a very diverse mix, it's not going to infest all of them. It'd just be kind of your wheat type species, wheat and rye and triticale that it could infest. So that is one part where we just got to watch it that we're giving it now a host there to survive the winter. It could be there in the spring then and just potentially something there that I traditionally, when I plant a cover crop, I didn't think about.
Sure.
And maybe we won't got to think about it until it does become a problem. But that is something that, as we look at more wheat, if we do find these Hessian fly pupae in the stems, you know, in your cover crop or in your wheat crop, that it's something to think about. So the, yeah, cover crop would be another one if you're using, and again, we use a lot of barley in cover crop. We use a lot of rye, some wheat as cover crop, but all those do get kind of intermixed, especially barley after wheat is a really good thing. Or we're doing more where we're trying to use the volunteer wheat as your cover crop, where you kind of spread out that chaff and get it to come better. But that is a host part for this. So I don't, do we think it's a problem now? No, but in the future, be something to watch out for, that if you're having yield reduction in your wheat or something you didn't anticipate, it's two things to think about are the Hessian fly and barley yellow dwarf virus.
Yeah. Just looking at the life cycle of them. So if you're terminating your cover crop, that may help. I can't find the exact...
When you say terminate too, do you mean fall or spring?
Like in spring, because they hatch.
Yeah.
They hatch in spring and develop in stages. So if they're... And just looking at what they do, it seems like they lay the eggs. The egg hatches inside, actually, the wheat grass, and then they'll eat, like, the head and inside of the stem. Like, the larvae will move through the plant inside. So if you're terminating, then you might be helping control that a little bit, too, where spray it down, it's getting run over. I can't find anything that says whether or not, yeah, the larvae would survive that kind of thing, but because it says they spend their summer in stubble. So, but yeah, no, it's definitely something to think about, and it's an interesting twist on a pest that, like I said, we don't really think about that much, but is very much still there and has a possibility of having an effect. So now we'll move on to our spotlight for today. You know what that sound means. It's GDU update time.
It's a good time. Especially in a hot week. I love having GDU updates.
Yes, our fall GDUs are probably above what we would normally expect.
Would you say, Todd, three times if you looked at normal?
Yeah, so normal. That was wild. Normal GDUs for, like, let's just use September 11th because that's a date we all remember. But normal GDUs is 8. And this year on September 11th, we had 23.
Whew.
So
almost triple.
Yes. So it's been good. I mean, usually fall time, you do expect it to cool off. And we're getting cooler nights like we talked about. But these highs during the day will definitely help push our corn to maturity.
Well, and with the variety of planting dates we've had, as you've got here, the GDUs, you got to look at it from planting, not necessarily just from the start of the year. So we've got Seymour here on the 1st, the 15th of May, and then the 15th of June.
Yeah, so I change it up a little bit with the wide planting window, like you're saying, Matt.
Yep.
We typically look from May 1st just because it's a good date, but it doesn't work as well this year. And there's enough variation that it was important to kind of look at each timing.
So yeah, on the 1st, so if you were planted at or around May 1st, to date we've had 2,224 GDUs, normals 2,218, so actually fairly close, only six growing degree units more above normal. But the next 14-day forecast, we're supposed to get up to 25, 29, so almost 300 growing degree units in the next 14 days.
I just looked it up. The 10-day forecast for Seymour is touching 80 every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we are close to 80 almost every day in the next 10. So this would make sense.
Yep. Then if you went to the 15th, we're at 2,097. So normal from that date would be 2,115. So we're actually 18 growing degree days behind from the 15th. And again, that 14-day forecast is supposed to jump up to 2,402. But now let's go into June. So June, if you planted around mid-June in our area, you're at 1,679 for growing degree units. Normal is 1,690, so you're behind the eight ball there with the being a level 11 GDUs below normal. And even with the favorable heat for coming in the next 14 days, still only going to jump up to 1984. Great year. I'm a big fan. The book, maybe not as great, but the year was really good. So, yeah, I mean, just look at that. From May 1st to the 15th of June, you're 600 growing degree days different. And so he explains a lot of what we're seeing out in the field. And, I mean, it makes sense. We're not questioning it by any means. Now, if we went down to Sun Prairie, in the southern part of the state, as of May 1st, they're at 2493. Normal for them is 2311. So they are 182 GDUs above normal. And they're expected to, looks like, get fairly similar weather. They're looking at 2798 after the next 14 days. If you go to the 15th of May, 2330. Normal for them is 2200. So still above normal there, 130 degree unit, growing degree units above normal. And then as of the 15th, they're at 1852, 15th of June. Their normal's 1733, so even later planted in June, they're still 119 GDUs above normal, and their 14-day forecast will get them above 2,000 growing degree units. So, yeah.
I swear Sun Prairie, every time we do this, is above normal.
Always above, yeah.
So I don't get what their normal is or what their...
They need to adjust their average.
Something seems always...
Just thinking about that as you're reading this, Matt, like at one point does the normal get adjusted?
Right. Well, I think normal is X amount of year average, really, but they might have had some really cold years in there or something.
Yeah, something's got to have really affected that.
Yeah.
All right. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So the Hessian fly that we discussed earlier, we'll continue to talk about here with our Ag History Minute. So Maetiola destructor was first observed in New York in 1779 near a Hessian soldier encampment, hence the name. From there, it spread rapidly throughout the United States. From 1900 to 1970, only about one of every 4 years was designated as being free of serious fly injury. Infestations were lower from the 1970s to the 1990s, but have increased in recent years in some of the plain states like Kansas. So there you go. They don't wear pointy helmets, but they were first spotted near Hessian soldiers. That's where they get the name. That's pretty interesting history. So it's not necessarily that they're from Germany, but they were spotted by
their neighbors.
Some Germans. Yeah.
Their neighbors were German.
Be interesting to talk to somebody from Kansas and hear their opinion on the Hessian fly.
I agree.
That's your goal in January.
Yes, at their next...
When you go to the NAICC, see if we can find somebody from Kansas. I did meet a guy, you know, I wish I would have known to ask this. Oh, it was like 3 years ago, went down to the precision planting farm they've got in Illinois, and we were there with some guys from Kansas. And we were talking wheat, but the Hessian fly did not come up in the conversation.
Yeah, because maybe they are like, guys, this is whatever.
It's a Hessian without aggression.
But the K-State, there was all the info, new info was from K-State. K-State. So, yes.
And they are known for wheat in that part of the
right, world. Right. And it did say kind of them those plain states, it's a problem. Well, good. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's very easy. Just search Tilt Talk Radio on Apple Podcasts or on an Android phone. Search for an app like Podcast Addict. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcast. You can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Now we'll get into our Cool Beans That's Corny and some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. A drone helped rescue a 3-year-old boy lost in a dark Wisconsin cornfield. Happened in Fond du Lac County. The sheriff's deputies received a call for help from a boy's parents that their son had wandered into the expansive 6-foot-tall cornfield behind their home. It's only 6 feet tall. Must be green corn. So the thermal drone footage shows the rescue of a 3-year-old who became lost after he wandered into a 100-acre cornfield alone and at night in Alto, Wisconsin. The video begins with the drone surveying the large expanse of the cornfield. The thermal image makes the rows appear textured black and white. So a lot of times thermal is kind of a black and white image. At around 9:30 p.m., so the call came in at 8:45, around 9:30, a bright white shape appeared to move through the corn, breaking up the monotonous pattern corn stalks formed in frame as the toddler. Once they had the heat signature, they were able to find the young boy. And so fortunately he was able to escape his corn prison and be returned to his family. They took about 15 minutes for them to find him and get him out of the cornfield. But yeah, it's kind of funny that just by Seymour, I think it was last weekend, there was a similar situation where a boy wandered into a cornfield. Luckily, they had a cop and a drone there, but it didn't end up needing it. They found the boy, but apparently this time of year is the year or the time when kids like to run into corn. So,
future corn scouts right there.
Yeah, hopefully now they've learned how to get out of a cornfield once they go in.
Just keep walking. At a 3-year-old, that's quite a... Yeah, that's a tough call.
Yeah. And I'm sure it was fun for the first little while, but after a while, especially in the dark.
Right.
Like the boy that was went into the corner around here, it was like in the afternoon, so at least you didn't have to sit out there in the dark. But I've been in cornfields during the day, and you hear noises and stuff walking through the corn, too, and you're like, okay, hopefully it's just a deer, not some rabid raccoon or something else hanging around.
Sometimes it's a bear, Matt.
Sometimes it's a bear.
It's a bear. Been there.
So, glad he was found safe. And
so this was a true Children of the Corn story?
Yes. He was a child of the corn for but a brief time. All right. Our That's Corny this week. Fertility costs are in focus as farmers consider cutting back. So from eye-popping numbers a few years ago, fertilizer prices are now below their recent record highs. However, some products have started to push up again in price, and that trend may continue through fall because of lower production from some key global exporters. Josh Linville, Vice President of Fertilizer with StoneX, said potash prices are stable, but some phosphate products like MAP are up as much as $70 per ton and now sell for a premium. The price of MAP, which is what a lot of farmers across the Midwest use, has skyrocketed and is up probably $50 to $70 a ton. According to Linville, MAP is typically $20 premium over DAP, and today it's closer to $100. That's because we've cut off a lot of world importers. It says China exports are down, Brazilian production remains offline, and European fertilizer production is down 25% due to high natural gas prices. That's also pushing some nitrogen products to higher prices as well. So, great. Always good to hear fertilizer prices going up, especially when commodities are down.
Keeps going down.
Yep.
My favorite line in the article is, agronomists confirm many growers have already decided to cut out their fertilizer programs for 2025. So, however, instead of slashing across the board, crop advisors suggest taking a strategic approach in order to preserve yield. So, yes, this is a good time to talk about, there is economics to it as well. Yeah. So,
yep.
Of how much and...
Yeah, do what you can. Don't sacrifice too much or you're going to kind of shoot yourself in the foot down the road. Especially, I mean, we're sitting here, we don't know... Silage is just kind of getting started. We don't know what our inventory is going to look like yet, so it's a little early to be making the decision to fully pull the plug on fertilizers, especially if nitrogen being one of those key ones that's rising. But, yeah, it'll definitely be discussions we have this fall, I'm sure. All right, now to wrap things up, we've got a Field Good Friday, and I know it's going to be tough, but... I think we can pull together and we can do it. Grape growers desperately need you to drink more wine as they are grappled with a glut of uncontracted grapes. So not just row crop farmers dealing with challenges. In California, prices are low for everything from nuts to fruit, and financial stress is weighing heavily on farmers. Grape growers are in particularly unique situation. Declining demand for wine, an increase in imported wine means there's a glut of grapes this year. And it's so bad there's a surge in the amount of unharvested grapes that still don't have a home. Now there are fears it could ultimately force more true family farmers out of business. So Jennifer Thompson took over her family farm in 2012. Napa Valley is broken into American viticultural areas, or AVAs. Thompson's vineyard is situated in the Los Carneros AVA. Thompson is one of the few family farms still left in the Napa Valley. So it's rare when you truly meet a family farmer who is hands-on and drives their own tractor and responsible for the selling of their own fruit and is responsible for paying taxes on the land. There's no middleman involved. That's rarity in 2024, she said. But, yeah, one of those folks who has extra grapes and is looking to hopefully find a home for them. She said, ultimately, all our contracts were canceled on December 31st, 2023, all of them with the exception of one. And her vineyard produces just under 300 tons of grapes each year. For the first time in more than a decade, two-thirds of her crop is uncontracted and without a home. So there's 200 tons of grapes out there that need your help.
It's a lot.
Just one glass a day.
Yes.
You could help.
Are we
some poor?
Are we encouraging binge drinking here?
Is that a glass a day? I don't think it's binge drinking. A bottle a day, perhaps.
That would be binge.
Isn't a glass a day supposed to help your heart
I think so. Yeah. There's health benefits.
Just being healthy. As for American-made wine, make sure you do that.
My wine is American-made. Yeah, none of the don't go for those foreign wines. Stick to this nice homegrown Napa Valley wine. Maybe we'll get to try some Napa Valley wine this winter.
Mm. Hoping so.
But yeah, no, it's an unfortunate problem for these grape farmers, but there is something you can do. You can go and drink more wine. And that's not too bad. So here we go. That's the do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
Today we talked about the Hessian fly and the impact it can have on wheat crops or similar grains like rye, triticale, and barley. In our spotlight, we took a look at the GDUs at some different planting times from this spring. Ag History Minute, we covered why the Hessian fly is known as the Hessian fly. Cool Beans this week was a drone rescue, found a lost boy in a Wisconsin cornfield. That's corny, was fertility costs potentially on the rise. And our Field Good Friday was go out and drink more wine because there's lots of extra grapes out in the Napa Valley. Thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.